ஸ்ரீ ரமண மகரிஷி த சேஜ் ஆஃப் திருவண்ணாமலை பை டாக்டர் ஜிஹெச் மீஸ் கேன்டாப். டியூரிங் தி 4 இயர்ஸ் தட் ஐ ஹவ் பீன் ட்ராவலிங் இன் இண்டியா, ஐ ஹவ் விசிட்டட் மெனி யோகிஸ் அண்ட் சாதுஸ் இன் வில்லேஜஸ் அண்ட் இன் ஜங்கல்ஸ், சம்டைம்ஸ் ஈவன் இன் டவுன்ஸ் இன் ஆல் பார்ட்ஸ் ஆஃப் திஸ் வாஸ்ட் கான்டினென்ட். When I heard of some man who was considered to be holy or wise, I always went to visit him, often to be disappointed, though occasionally to find what I had expected. However, those that really mattered, I always met by chance, as the expression goes, and to this rule, Ramana Maharishi forms an exception. I suppose the Maharishi is the only one of the living Maharishis who does not mind leading a public life. The sacrifice of this publicity must be enormous, though one has to remind oneself again and again that there is nothing which either troubles or disturbs him. His daily life, the life that the Maharishi leads, would drive any other man mad within a short time, for practically every moment of his existence he is a center of public interest. Not even a moment is he alone. His is the life of a sacred animal or a god. After a sleep of some hours, which cannot be called sleep in the ordinary sense of the word, the Maharishi gets up, goes to the simple kitchen of the ashram, and occupies himself for some hours in cutting and preparing the vegetables of the simple, purely vegetarian meals of the community. In this work, he is helped by the others who happen to be awake at such an early hour. At 6:30, after his bath, breakfast is taken. Coffee with cakes made of rice flour. After that, the Maharishi sits practically all day on his couch in the hall of the ashram, to leave it only for meals at 11 and at 8 o'clock, and for the small walks he takes on the slopes of the sacred hill. At sunrise and at sunset, Brahmin priests of the Orthodox Vedic school come to recite hymns from the Yajurveda while seated at the feet of the sage. More correctly, it may be described as a half singing, half reciting of the sacred hymns. It is a most impressive and solemn procedure. All day, visitors come and go, greeting the Maharishi with divine honor by prostrating themselves on the floor at full length with hands folded above the head. These demonstrations of homage do not make any more impression on the sage than the ordinary greetings of any other person. It is the classical Indian tradition thus to honor sages, and the Maharishi leaves people complete freedom to express themselves as they please. Visitors sit for hours at the feet of the Maharishi in a hall in which nothing else is found than the couch of the sage and some bookcases. They meditate, sing religious songs, very often hymns in glory of Arunachala Shiva, and sometimes they ask Maharishi questions concerning religious or philosophical problems. As a rule, the Maharishi is silent, but sometimes he may give lengthy explanations if he thinks that such might be of any use, as he is always ready to speak some pleasant words to visitors, especially to the children who come to see him. He is always normal and natural in his attitude and behavior. I may say without the slightest hesitation that he is the most natural and unconstrained person I have ever had the benefit to know. He completely lacks any pretense. To use a phrase of analytic psychology, he is a man without a person. Because of his total absence of pretense, his personality, paradoxically, leaves an overwhelming impression. Many sadhus and yogis might wish to convince visitors and devotees of their wisdom, holiness, or spiritual powers. Yet, the slightest attempt to impress at once takes away for me the possibility of an authentic or true impression. It is extremely difficult to describe the atmosphere that emanates from this extraordinary man. Contradictions meet in him. One is struck at once by his childlike simplicity and also his noble wisdom, by the familiar and by something strikingly uncommon. Though the Maharishi spent a large part of his life in seclusion on the sacred hill of Arunachala, he has never said that seclusion is better than a life in the world, or that it is essential for obtaining enlightenment. He says that a man who comes to self-realization can live anywhere without being disturbed or influenced in any way by his surroundings. One of his sayings runs, "Renunciation is not the discarding of externals, but the cancellation of the uprising of the ego." To the true sannyasin, there is no difference between solitude and an active life. In his own life, which is entirely public, he gives a demonstration of this. One feels, one knows that there is nothing that can touch him. One feels also, especially during the time of the temple festival in Thiruvannamalai, when for several weeks thousands come to him daily and policemen have to regulate the traffic, that superhuman powers are necessary to enable a man to make such a total sacrifice of any vestige private life. Enlightenment. There is much talk about samadhi, a state of consciousness corresponding to nirvana or the nirvana of the Buddhists. And I have seen in several Indian sages such a state of spiritual abstraction or absorption, trance, if one likes to call it so. There are several kinds of samadhi, everyone with its own technical terms. Here, it does not matter very much what those terms are. In the Maharishi alone, I feel that I see the highest state of absolute consciousness. The fascinating element in it is formed by the fact that one has to recognize that at one and the same time, he is absorbed in a state of consciousness which defies description and is yet conscious of the very ordinary things of daily life around him. The highest and the lowest are united for him, and in him, perhaps not only united, but realized as one in essence. God and the world and his deepest self are to him one. The teachings. His doctrine is that of philosophical idealism in its highest flights. It is Advaita Vedanta, the monistic philosophy of the Hindus embodied in a human being. In a few words, it comes down to the following: the individual subject and the divine subject are one in essence. This is the only truth and reality. The world, apart from this, is a changing dream, a world of appearance from the point of view of that reality. The process of creation which takes place within every man is Maya. To the man who lives in the world, and that every man does, Maya is not an illusion, but a state of affairs which has to be taken into account and from which one cannot run away. The reproach of many Western thinkers based on this Maya conception is that Hinduism is averse to the world and negates it, but this is unfounded. Hinduism has a large measure of practical sense, perhaps rather too large to measure. Maya is the play of the Lord. Maya is necessary for self-realization. One should accept it completely. Its acceptance is part of the spiritual path, the Master's guidance. The Maharishi sees through life's illusions. His message is that of all the great rishis of India and is striking only by the new comparisons. His presence, his being, forms the liberating element. He is, as it were, a vast magnet for humanity, one that attracts not to bind men, but to liberate them from the burdens and problems which they carry along with them. Other teachers often bind their visitors or disciples with new bonds. Because people feel this intuitively, they tend to keep at a distance from such teachers. As regards the Maharishi, however, they know intuitively that he does not want anything from them, and therefore all experience a sense of freedom in his presence. And moreover, they feel that the great experience of the presence of the Maharishi does not consist in the Maharishi's entering into their own soul, but that in their soul, their own inner Maharishi is awakening. Though the Maharishi is a sage, a jnani, and not an ecstatic bhakta like Sri Ramakrishna, yet he is full of warm human interest and advocates bhakti or the path of love. His conception of religion and service in the world finds expression, for instance, in such lines as the following. If we just but recognize this universe of eightfold form as form of God Himself and serve in adoration all the world, this is of God most excellent worship. Upadesa Saram, verse number 5. Meditation has been for the Maharishi only a systematic striving towards self-realization. As he says, it is not a particular posture of the body, nor closing of the eyes, nor something for a particular time of the day. Though, of course, all these things are of help in this system, but it is an attitude of life for all hours of the day and night, for all stages of activity and rest in life. The best form of meditation is that which continues not merely in the waking state, but extends to the dream state and the deep sleep state of the aspirant. One's meditation should be so intense that it leaves no room for the conscious idea, "I am meditating." He counsels anyone who comes to him with an open heart seeking his advice, but he does not allow people to call themselves his disciples openly or to set him up as their guru. His relationship with people is an inner one that is far too subtle and too sacred a subject for conversation. Very often, the pith of his advice is to stimulate his visitors to search for the real I. What is the basis of consciousness? People have to discover that Jiva, the individual I, and Shiva are in essence one. It is not of much value to come to this conclusion through mere reasoning. If there is no realization to that effect, it may even do harm. Visitors to the Maharishi. Many Europeans have already been to visit the Maharishi and have written about him. It is almost a pity that the life-giving element in this remarkable man is not in the first place his words or deeds, but in the simple fact of his presence, since only a few people in the world can benefit from that. Some Europeans I spoke with after they had visited the Maharishi considered that it had been more than worthwhile to go all the way to India for this visit alone. An officer of high rank in the English Army, Major A.W. Chadwick, came to India some years ago just to see the Maharishi, and he has remained in the ashram ever since, something which is quite an achievement for an European, and especially for an Englishman, in the rather strange South Indian surroundings. In conclusion, here are some verses selected from the Maharishi's works, translated together with Maharishi by the Englishman referred to above. No matter to what form or name you pray, it is but a means of finding the Supreme, who transcends name and form. Grow then aware of your true self in Him, immaculate, and merge in that, the beatific peace, for thus is perfect realization found. The pairs of opposites, the trinities, all have their source in something that is real. Seek out this basis in the depth of mind. The basis found, then these will disappear. To find it is to realize the truth and rest unmoved within the ultimate. For him who thinks the body is the self, the thoughts, I am not this and I am that, are helpful in the search. But why should one be even dwelling on this, I am that? Is there a person who thinks, I am a man, once, ever, that alone, without the thought? Who else is there apart from one's true self? What matters it what other people say? It is just as if one praised or blamed oneself. So, never feel that thou art separate, nor swerve from that thine own reality, but always stand thou steadfast in the I. Let me proclaim with no uncertain voice the essence of Vedanta and the pith of all the other schools. Let ego die and let thyself be that. There then is left pure consciousness, the self, that is the I, and this is all that there remains of truth.